During the COVID-19 pandemic, the number of Americans dying of alcohol-related liver disease spiked, and the mortality rate continues to rise. I'm Jill Najoe. Thanks for joining us on The Larry Mueller Show today. Why are so many people drinking themselves to death? Well, we'll ask our next guest, Dr. Rita German, a hepatologist who leads a multidisciplinary alcohol-associated liver disease clinic for UW Health. Have you seen friends and family increase their alcohol consumption in the recent years? Do you wonder why or how you can help them? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. German, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. This is a big deal. I don't understand. Are you guys understanding what's going on?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is not just a problem that we've seen since the pandemic. It's really been a problem for the last kind of two decades. And there were some studies early on that showed that over the last two decades, we've seen this increasing rate of alcohol-associated liver disease, really driven by this alcohol use disorder. We have tried to go away from the stigmatizing language of calling it alcoholism or alcoholic. So you'll hear me say a lot, alcohol use disorder. That's the term that we like to use because patients are people and, you know, the disease doesn't define them. So it's a person with this disease. So we've been seeing these higher rates, and particularly and really scarily, we've been seeing these higher rates in younger populations. So 25 to 40 year olds, then we see patients come in with alcohol associated liver disease, even to the point of cirrhosis, dying from liver disease in these younger and younger groups, where previously, you know, you would have thought, oh, cirrhosis is somebody in their 60s, 70s or older. But really, we've seen it younger and younger in this population. And really, it is correlated with this rates of alcohol use disorder. And that, as you mentioned, has really taken a jump since the pandemic. I think a lot of times patients were sort of self-medicating themselves during the pandemic, you know, the social isolation, treating their anxiety, depression with alcohol use, it sort of became more normalized. You know, it was kind of fun. Like, what are we doing during the day? Okay, let's just have a drink. We can have a drink at 12 o'clock now because we're home working or we're stressed about the pandemic, we're stressed about childcare issues, kind of the normalization of it. And then obviously, you know, our Wisconsin culture, you can't go anywhere without having a drink. It's just something we normalize. We talk about a lot, you know, we have funny memes about it, like Thirsty Thursdays and things like that. So it's just this normal culture in America that has really driven these higher drinking in higher quantities. And then that correlates with the rise in alcohol-associated liver disease.
Although at the same time, we're seeing a lot of people talking about, you know, dry January.
Yes.
There's mocktails. There's bars that don't offer alcohol at all. Is there some light at the end of the tunnel here that you're seeing?
I sure hope so. It seems like maybe the younger population has caught on.
Okay.
And they seem to be doing this a little bit better than maybe the prior generations have. I think that, you know, while it may be a nice, a good turning point, I still think that we're going to keep seeing these high rates because it's just not going to be totally pervasive in our society. But I am really encouraged by it. There's, you know, this stores that only sell mocktails and stores that only sell NA beers and things like that. So I do think that's taking a turn, and hopefully people are becoming more aware of the issue and working towards solving this problem. But I do think that, unfortunately, we're going to still see these rates of alcohol-associated liver disease. But maybe we can hope for the future.
Can hope. And the acceptance of people not drinking is probably a good thing to cultivate too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that that's very true.
So how much alcohol consumption really can cause liver damage?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the NIAAA, which is the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse, really says that for women, the safe amount to drink in somebody without liver disease, so just a general population, less than one drink a day or less than seven per week. And one drink is considered a 5-ounce glass of wine, one 12-ounce beer, or a 1.5-ounce shot of liquor. So those are all equivalent to one drink. Anything more than that would really be more than a drink. So like a 16-ounce beer, 24-ounce beers, now we're getting into, that's two drinks.
Mm-hmm.
For men, it's less than two drinks a day or less than 14 per week. That's the safe amount. there are guidelines for binge drinking. So having more than four drinks in a span of 4 or 5 hours for women would be unsafe, having more than five for men. So it's a little bit lower for women, a little bit higher for men. But in order to get a liver disease associated with that, you really have to be drinking at much higher levels. You know, we see patients who drink closer to like a 1.75 liter bottle of vodka a week, or sometimes, you know, a bottle of wine per day. So that would be 4 to 5 drinks a day. So those levels would be certainly harmful to your liver and certainly can cause fat to develop in your liver, which is sort of the first sign of injury. And then over time, scar tissue develops in your liver and then cirrhosis. So really anything more than what I mentioned as the safe amount could be potentially harmful. But really, those higher rates are required to really get significant damage to your liver. The other good thing, though, is damage is reversible. So if, let's say, there is fat in their liver, even some scar tissue, that can be reversed with abstinence. And so we really encourage our patients to get seen, and if they are concerned about their liver, because there's still stuff, a lot of things we can do to reverse it before it gets too late.
So what would some of the symptoms be initially for liver disease?
Yeah, that's the tricky part, is there are really no symptoms, especially early on. The only thing you may see is some elevation in liver enzymes. You might see some fat in the liver, but that's usually found because they're looking for something else and they happen to do a test to look at their liver. So a lot of times this is a silent disease, which is why it's really troublesome, because we usually don't catch it until it's too late. By the time patients have symptoms, and some of those symptoms might be, they may notice their skin turning yellow, their eyes turning yellow. They may notice some swelling in their abdomen, but those are some late signs. And so even when they develop those signs, some of that can actually improve significantly with abstinence, but we don't want to wait until it gets to that point. We really want to know much sooner than that, so we can prevent getting to that point, essentially. But yeah, that's the really tricky part about liver disease and why it may be so progressive by the time they come to us, is you just wouldn't know.
What does the liver do for us in our body?
Yeah, the liver is a vital, vital organ. So the liver does a lot of things. It makes clotting factors, so helps your blood not bleed out. It also makes factors to make your blood thinner, so to make it, so it kind of stabilizes your blood. It clears out all the toxins in your blood. It clears out all the medications in your blood. So if you're taking medications, usually the liver or the kidneys are the ones that clear those medications. The liver makes lots of proteins that are vital for your organs to function, for your lungs to function. So, I mean, it is a very, very important organ. And if it's not functioning, it's really troublesome. And we don't have something like dialysis, which we may have for the kidneys, that can sort of replace the function. There's just nothing else that the liver, you know, the liver can replace the function of the liver.
So what happens when someone does get to the point where, you know, they are looking yellowish, you know that something's going on with their liver. What happens at that point?
Yeah, so they're usually seen in our clinic, hopefully, or we see them in the hospital, you know, if it's significant. And we really try to counsel, tease out if there's anything else going on. So the trouble thing is that, you know, patients may have alcohol-associated liver disease, but there can be secondary causes as well. So we'll rule out other secondary causes, some genetic disorders that can cause issues with the liver. But the other big factor is that we're seeing high rates of obesity, right? So we have another epidemic is the obesity epidemic. And obesity and things like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, that can also put fat into the liver and lead to scar tissue. So if you have one of the risk factors, your progression might be sort of linear. If you have both of those risk factors, that progression might be kind of accelerated much faster. And so if they have these other factors, that may cause their progression of liver disease to be much quicker. So what do we do? Whenever we see them in our clinic, you know, first we tease out, excuse me, what's the main cause here? And what can we do about it? Then we tease out, what's the degree of scar tissue in the liver? Is there just fat in the liver? Is there a lot of scar tissue? Is there cirrhosis? And then we try to treat the underlying process. So if there's an alcohol use disorder that's associated with it, we don't just treat the liver disease. We have to be really good at treating the alcohol use disorder. So we talk about medications that can help with cravings. We talk about referral to counseling for alcohol use disorder, giving them every single possible tool to make sure that they maintain abstinence and help heal their liver. And the liver, luckily, is a pretty resilient organ. It's pretty incredible. And so with time and abstinence, the liver can really recover significantly. So even fat can go away, even the yellowing of the skin and the eyes can improve. even some of the complications of cirrhosis can improve. So really, it's not too late. It's not, you know, to the point of no return. The sooner that we see these patients, the better, because we really can turn things around as long as they're sort of willing to work with us and make sure that we treat their alcohol use disorder, because that's a disease just like the liver.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Rita German. She is a hepatologist and leads a multidisciplinary alcohol associated liver disease clinic for UW Health. If you've got any questions for her, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. You know, I've never heard of a hepatologist before, I have to say. Can you explain
that's
a little
a good
bit
thing.
Of yeah, I guess. So what is the discipline? What do you cover in your practice?
Oh, that's a good question. So a hepatologist is a specific doctor that treats the liver. So my specialty, whenever you're a liver doctor, you also go through GI training. So I've done training to be a gastroenterologist. So I do a lot of procedures like colonoscopy, endoscopy, but then I did additional training to specifically be a liver specialist. So what does that entail? Well, I see patients from all walks of life who have any problems with their liver, whether it's alcohol or anything else. We also take care of patients who may be undergoing liver transplant. So let's say their liver disease is severe and they need a liver transplant. So I take care of patients before and after their liver transplant as well. Now, I don't do the surgery side, so I don't do the actual transplant. Those are our transplant surgeons who are phenomenal. I just do the medical side of treating any aspect of their liver health, essentially.
Sure. What got you interested in that particular side of medicine?
Yeah, that's I get that question a good amount. So I really had some great mentors during residency, specifically a hepatologist who saw a lot of patients with hepatitis C, and it was phenomenal to kind of witness. So in hepatitis C, in 2014, there was new medications that came out to treat and cure hepatitis C. And that kind of revolutionized the field of hepatology. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're like discovering new things all the time. This is incredible. And it's kind of interesting to, you know, see somebody who has elevated liver enzymes really be able to do something about it, really be able to diagnose, treat, fix the problem. So I really love that aspect of my job. I love interacting with patients that have these issues and really trying to connect with them and make sure that, you know, they know that we're here for them. You know, we're really trying to destigmatize all of this. We're trying to talk to patients as if, you know, they're human beings first, and then they have these conditions and we treat those conditions, but we need to know that that condition does not define them as a person. And we are just here to help and not pass judgment, and really just to connect them with the resources they need. And that's really the point of that multidisciplinary clinic, that we have hepatologists like myself, we have social workers, and we have addiction medicine specialists in that clinic. And we all work together to make sure that we are treating every aspect of that disease to the fullest extent we can.
That's wonderful. We've got some calls coming in, so let's go to Patty in Green Bay. Go right ahead, Patty.
My sister developed liver problems after she started chemo, and she got lymphoma, and she got an antibody treatment, and then she got some chemo with that, and her liver just fell apart. But they sent her to a liver specialist, and he just kept accusing her of being an alcoholic and wouldn't listen to anything she said. And so there was nothing else that they could offer her. They said she'll probably need a liver transplant within the year, because her numbers were so high. And so we ended up talking to an herbalist, and he said after some research, he directed us to Spanish black radish. And she started taking that, and within 2 weeks, her numbers were down by half. And within another 2 months, they were completely in the normal range, and because she stopped taking it for a little while, and their numbers went back up.
Well, yeah. So what? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. I was going to say, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. One is that yes, there are certain chemotherapies that can certainly cause liver injury. Absolutely. So there's something called immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we frequently see what's called immune checkpoint inhibitor hepatitis or drug-induced liver injury. So there's lots of medications that can cause injury to your liver. A lot of times with removal of that medication, the liver enzymes can improve. Now, in your sister's situation, obviously, I don't know the specific details, And I'm not sure why they thought that potentially there might be some alcohol use. There is a certain type of pattern we see with liver injury if it's related to alcohol. It certainly can be other things, but that's some maybe why they thought that, because of a specific pattern they saw. But in case that this was related to the immune checkpoint inhibitor, potentially just removal of that agent may have improved the liver enzymes. I will. I would say that, you know, if you've had an opinion with a provider and you just weren't, you know, fully satisfied with that opinion, it is always recommended to seek a second opinion. So you can certainly come see a different liver specialist, another provider, just to make sure that, you know, they look things over. And, you know, we see a lot of second opinions here at UW, and there's not a lot of liver providers outside of sort of major institutions, because we're sort of situated around transplant centers, but we certainly do outreach clinics. So one of our liver providers, actually a couple, actually go out to Green Bay and see patients out there. We have some outreach clinics. So again, potentially seeking a second opinion. The other thing I want to really caution about is herbal supplements. You know, I know that there's a lot out there, but the problem with herbal supplements is they're not FDA regulated. And so you really have to be cautious about them, because while they may say, okay, this is going to help your liver, inadvertently, it actually may cause more problems than good. And there's not been randomized controlled studies that can show that, you know, this medication or this herbal supplement has shown to reduce the risk of liver disease, et cetera. So I'd really, really caution against using herbal supplements without running it by your providers, because they sometimes can actually cause more harm than good. So I'm so happy to hear that your sister is doing better, but just be cautious about that as well, okay?
Thank you, Patty, for that call. Cara in Duluth, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My dad he died from liver cancer, and when they caught him, he had NASH, and but he wasn't a drinker, but he was obese, and I come from a family of big people, and I am obese. I've tried to be very careful of my weight and watch what I eat, but I'm still a big person. And for my height, I'm just under 5'1", and I'm 180 pounds. So I'm not tiny, but I know I have fatty liver. But my curiosity question is, even though I try to behave and my liver values are fine, I'm still concerned about heredity factors of liver disease, and that I may go the same route as my dad, and he wasn't a drinker. So,
yeah. So I'm sorry to hear about your dad, and you're correct that there is certainly a genetic component to this as well. So especially with, so you mentioned NASH. So that's what we used to call NASH, which is non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. We actually now call it MASH, or MASLD, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. It's a mouthful. We call it MASLD. But essentially, the terminology changed, but the disease hasn't changed. It's just a way to describe it better for what it is rather than what it isn't. So we used to say non-alcoholic, now we say what it actually is, which is these risk factors that you mentioned: obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. So in patients who have obesity, there's certainly not everybody is going to develop fat in their liver, but MASLD is very prevalent. And we see about a quarter of the US population have fat in their liver. And it's very prevalent as well. Just like, you know, we've been talking about alcohol a lot, but MASLD is very prevalent as well. And obesity can increase that risk. Excuse me. So when you have fat in the liver, with weight loss, with exercise, that fat can improve. And, you know, sometimes weight loss and exercise just aren't adequate to get rid of the fat in the liver. There are some medications. There's one medication called resmetirom that was recently approved for patients with stage 2 scar tissue and fat in the liver from MASLD. But the other really revolutionary medications, and I'm sure everyone's heard about these, is like things like Ozempic and Wegovy and Mounjaro, so GLP-1 inhibitors. And there's been lots of studies that actually look and show that specifically these GLP-1 inhibitors can not only help with weight loss, they actually can improve fat reduction and scar tissue in the liver. And so that's certainly something to talk to your primary care doctors about and see if you are a candidate for one of those medications. You know, the tricky part is the insurance coverage. It's very expensive. It's hard to get them covered by insurance. But if you can, and if that's something that you'd be interested, that may be an option as well. But yes, MASLD is a very big prevalent problem. And obesity, you know, if you already have fat in the liver, while the progression is quite slow, that progression still can occur where that fat turns into scar tissue and cirrhosis over time.
Thank you for that call, Cara, and definitely check with your medical providers for that, because that may help you. Rachel in Milwaukee, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you knew anything about PANS, like P-A-N-S. There's also pandas. I have a friend that is an adult with PANS. He's 26. And I believe that something, like, it can cause issues with the liver. And I was wondering if you knew anything that I could relay or things that I could do to help him out with that.
Can you say, so
it's
what did you say?
PANS? Yeah, T-A-N-S disease.
I actually do not, I have not heard of that. I'm not sure what that stands for, but no, I'm so sorry that I'm not sure what that is exactly and how that relates to the liver in this case.
Yeah. Sorry, Rachel. Is that something that she could tell her friend to maybe contact your organization about, that they could help out with that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, if there's concerns with her liver and her primary doctor feels that she should be seeing a liver specialist, they should absolutely send her a referral to our center.
Your center. Okay. Sounds good. And we did get a question from Leah by email to say that the frequency that she sees of liver or gut detox ads all over social media, is detoxing a real thing? Is it a need or is it just a buzzword?
Long story short, it's probably just a buzzword. There's no really need to detox your liver. Your liver is the detox center of your body. So the way to detox your liver is just to avoid alcohol, work on keeping a healthy diet, healthy exercising. Things like Mediterranean diet is really recommended. That has been shown to really help with MASLD and keeping fat out of your liver. And, you know, if you want to detox your liver, coffee is actually great for your liver. There's actually, funny enough, there's been some studies that show that coffee can help reduce some fat in your liver. So 2 to 3 cups a day, go get your coffee. We're not talking about the fancy lattes, frappuccinos, okay, here. We're talking
about
some black coffee with a little bit of cream. But no, those detoxes really, you don't need to do that. That's more of a gimmick, and it kind of takes your money away.
Okay, I'm thinking there's a lot of researchers out there that drink coffee, because there are a lot of studies that show coffee is good for you. I think that's very funny.
I tell people to stop a lot of things, but one thing I tell them to do is drink your coffee.
Yes, unless you have a problem with caffeine like I do. So,
yes.
No, thank you. But let's talk a little bit more about, the drinking culture that we have here in Wisconsin. It's very strong. What are some of the things that you're teaching your patients about this culture? I mean, it's not easy.
It's not easy. I think one of the things we try to work with our patients on is first figuring out where they are in their journeys. You know, by the time, if they're seeing us, really, they have liver disease and they truly can't drink anything. You know, there's no safe amount of alcohol for them to drink. If somebody is drinking problematically and are concerned about their drinking and their liver is fine, you know, it is so important to seek out addiction medicine counseling and help, because they can help with figuring out the best way to work through that pattern of drinking. And, you know, even if you're maybe not don't have unhealthy drinking patterns, you know, even alternating. So let's say you're like, okay, I usually have 3 drinks a night. I really want to cut down. Have 1 drink and then alternate. Have a non-alcoholic and then have, you know, you can have another drink. And again, this is for patients who don't have liver disease, but really trying to change that framework. And I think more and more people are becoming accepting of patients, you know, people that don't drink. And it's just not something you do. And I think that's becoming a little bit, hopefully, more pervasive. You know, if you really feel inclined that you are going to be in a situation where you feel like you need to have a drink or look like it, you know, you just get a club soda with a lime. You know, nobody needs to know. yeah, exactly. So, but mocktails are really, truly becoming really on all menus at restaurants, at bars. They have all these mocktails. They have all these NA beers. The thing to watch out for the NA beers, that if you really shouldn't have any alcohol, making sure that you get the 0.0 NA beer. Some NA beers still have some alcohol, so just being careful with that. But it's tough. It's tough changing the whole culture. you know, sometimes when I tell my patients to not, they can't drink ever again, they're like, what about football Sunday? I'm like, well, yeah, that still counts. You know, yes. We got to work on it, but it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. And I know I have a friend who stopped drinking and he said that the new NA beers are amazing and he really can't tell the difference. So
yes, absolutely. Give it a try. You know, there's a place down in Middleton, Wisconsin here that's called the Sober Social. Not that I'm not advertising, but they have all NA stuff. It's just like, I mean, you can find it everywhere now. Yeah. I love it. It makes me happy.
It's much easier, much easier. And you had mentioned earlier that young adults are getting this disease more, but also there are increases in with women and American Indian populations too. So we got to go. That's what the music is telling me. Thank you, Lee.
Okay.
We're having such a great
true.
Conversation. Thank you so much for being with us. We are talking with Dr. Rita Germain. She's a hepatologist from UW Health. Hopefully you can come back and talk to us again sometimes. It's been great.
I would love to.
And we'll be back right after this look at the news.